A national day of reflection has been held in Australia, 1 week on from the Bondi Beach shooting, in which 15 people attending a Jewish festival were killed by two gunmen. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, was booed by the crowd at a memorial ceremony in Sydney. He's been accused of failing to stem the tide of anti-Semitism in the country. Our reporter Phil Mercer says security at the event was high.
I've never seen anything like it. I can see flashing police lights. There are many private security guards, police on horseback, on motorbikes, out to sea, on launches. The riot squad is here. There is an immense security presence. And we also saw on rooftops what might have been snipers. So this has been an extremely secure event.
The government's confirmed plans to ban trail hunting in England and Wales as part of its strategy to improve animal welfare. Ministers will hold a consultation in the new year, arguing the practice is used to cover up the illegal killing of foxes. It's already banned in Scotland. The latest figures from the Home Office show that 803 migrants in 13 boats crossed the Channel yesterday. It takes the total for the year to more than 41,000 people, the second highest number recorded. Two human rights organisations say Saudi Arabia has executed at least 347 people this year, surpassing the record from last year. Reprieve and the European Saudi Organisation for Human Rights said in a report that most were carried out for non-violent drug offences and more than half were foreigners. Israel's Security Cabinet has approved the establishment of 19 new settlements in the occupied West Bank, a move that the country's far-right finance minister said was aimed at preventing the establishment of a Palestinian state. It brings the total number of settlements approved over the past 3 years to 69. Thousands of people have gathered at Stonehenge in Wiltshire to watch the winter solstice sunrise. The stones at the Neolithic site are deliberately placed to line up with the sun's movements during the summer and winter solstices. And the weather, bright spells and some showers in the west, cloudy elsewhere with outbreaks of rain moving into the south later on. Highs of 11 degrees in London, 10 in Cardiff, Belfast and Manchester and 9 in Edinburgh. That's the BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The poet Pam Ayres first won a vast national audience 50 years ago when she appeared on the television talent show Opportunity Knocks. In the decades since, she's sold millions of books. But it's as a performer that she really comes into her own, with her distinctive Berkshire burr and her ability to make us laugh and cry. She's been called the people's poet, equally at home sending up our foibles as tackling life's major events. And the road to success wasn't straightforward. She first worked in the civil service and the WRAF, where her bosses told her she did not have the necessary aptitude, the title of her memoir. Pam, you brought us Elgar, Rachmaninoff, Chopin, but we're going to start with something festive, I think, a sacred Christmas carol, Gaudete.
Yes, I do love this. And it also reminds me of the folk clubs, because in the 70s, a rash of folk clubs appeared all around the country. And it was terrific for me because they gave me a place to perform and try out the things I'd written. The publicans, if they had a pub and they didn't have many customers on a Tuesday or a Thursday, say, then they would declare it a folk club and they would whitewash some old shed and put a horse collar or a plough or something on the wall and say, this is a folk club night on Thursday. And people would come and buy beer and cider and sing. And so even though I lived out in the sticks, this was just after I came out of the WRAF and I was at a bit of a loss. And I had a boring clerical job working for the works engineer and writing about duck boards and guttering and stuff like that, which didn't interest me in the slightest. But in the evenings, I could go around to one or another of the local pubs and I could play my guitar and my mother's ukulele, and I could throw in a few of my funny poems. And so they gave me a place, a friendly place, to try out the things I was writing. And at the same time, other people were doing the same thing. Billy Connolly, Max Boyce, Jasper Carrot, Mike Harding. We were all working around the folk clubs and cutting our teeth, if you like. And I heard wonderful people. One day, Steel Ice Band came along and they stood on the stage and they sang this.
Gaudete, Christus Esnatus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete, 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 Christus Esnatus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete.
Deposades Matiae hoc quod optimamus, Camine latitiae devoti redamus.
Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus Esnatus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete, 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 Christus es natus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete.
Deus homo factus est, natura mirante, mundus renovatus est, per Christo regnante.
Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus es natus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete, 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 Christus es natus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete.
Ese celis porta clausa per transita, onde lux est ota salus infinita.
Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus es natus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete, 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 Christus es natus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete.
Ego nostro cantio, salutiam in lustro, benedicat Domino, salus regi nostro.
Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus es natus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete, 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 Christus es natus, Ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete.
I love that. I love the way people can harmonise. And that was one of the things that struck me about the folk clubs, that people you wouldn't look at twice in the street could get up on the stage and they could sing and harmonise their voices in a way that just gave me the goosebumps. It's thrilling.
Gaudete, performed by Steel Eyes Span. You were born, Pamers, in the Vale of the White Horse in what was then Berkshire, the youngest of six children. So what was Christmas like growing up in your house?
Well, we got a pair. My sister and I got a pair of slippers with a pom-pom on the front and usually a box of Cadbury's milk tray, which we scoffed on Christmas morning. There were eight of us altogether in a council house with two rooms downstairs, no bathroom, no sanitation, just a bucket, not wishing to be crude, but, you know, it was pretty primitive. But you didn't think about that because nobody I knew had anything more.
Do you remember your first Christmas tree?
Yes, I do indeed. Our first Christmas tree was something very, very special. And in one way, it wasn't special at all because my brother stole it. There was a wood near us, there still is, called Hatford Warren, a lovely big wood where I used to ride a borrowed pony on lovely sandy soil. And it was full of Scots pines and they kind of whispered above you. It was a lovely wood. And my brother's, as Christmas approached, disappeared in the direction of Hatford Warren and came back with a top of one of the conifers. So they stole it. But the joy that it brought to my sister and I was immeasurable. And the fragrance of that pine tree that filled our home, I'll never forget it. A mum went to the chemist and got us a roll of cotton wool, which you could buy a big hard roll wrapped up in navy blue paper. And my sister and I pulled little bits off it and made snow and put all over our tree. And mum got us some silver strips and we put those on. And that was the finest Christmas tree I ever remember, although it was obtained by nefarious means.
As one of six siblings, did you get much attention from your parents?
I don't think they had time to give any of us a great deal of attention, because I was born in 47, just after the war, and everybody had to work, you know. I remember mum saying that when my eldest brother Tony went out to work, he got 25 shillings a week, and she always seemed to feel guilty. She said, I had to take a pound off him. I had to take 20 shillings off him and just leave him with 5 shillings, because I had to have it for the children, for the food. So, you know, we were pretty hard up, although, as I say, I didn't feel hard up at the time. Nobody I knew had anything more. And our dad, Stanley, who'd been in the Grenadier Guards for a long time, was a sergeant in the Grenadier Guards. He was the most industrious person, and he had a huge garden at the back of our house, all the council houses did, and he had 2 huge allotments at the other end of the village, and he grew prodigious amounts of food for us, so I was never hungry. But, you know, money was a bit tight.
Rachmaninoff next.
Yeah, I was not exposed to classical music at all. My brothers used to bring home the pop music of the day, the Lonnie Donegan, the Billy Fury, the Joe Brown and his brothers and all that. But somehow, by some means, and I can't remember what it was, I heard Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto, and I thought it was a heavenly sound. And it was the first classical record I ever bought. So where I'd usually gone into the record shop in Wantage and asked for the Rolling Stones or something, I went and asked for a bit of Rachmaninoff, and I've always loved it.
Thank you.
It thrills me to the soul. I can't say more than that, really.
The opening of the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor. Yu Zhuwang was playing the piano with the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. If there wasn't much classical music at home, Pamez, were there books?
No. There weren't. We had two books in our house. We had an awful book called Character from the Face, which was a succession of photographs of people's features, noses and eyes and ears, etc. And it claimed that you could tell whether the person was saintly or a villain by these various isolated pictures of nostrils, etc. So that was a peculiar book. And then we also had an awful book about birds, but it was where the birds had all been given a horrible voice, so the sparrow spoke in an awful Cockney voice. I hated both of those books. But at the village school, it was announced one day that we now had a library, and it was housed on one shelf about a metre long. And I went along, we had a lovely teacher called Miss Edmonds, and she knew I was interested in ponies, and she gave me Wish for a Pony by Monica Edwards, and she gave me Just William by Richmore Crompton, and I loved them both, and that really started me off as an avid reader.
You've written about your mother, Phyllis. She had shown real potential at school, so what happened?
Well, my mother was very good at English. She loved English, and she could always advise me if I was stuck on a word or didn't know the meaning of a word. And she lived in a hamlet with the picturesque name of Balkin. And in Balkin, she went to the village school in Uffington, and she was offered a scholarship. But she was one of five children. Her dad was killed on the railway when she was 18 months old, and they couldn't afford to do anything but to just go to the ordinary school. And she left school at 14 years of age and went into domestic service, which she hated.
How did you get on at school?
Well, it varied, really. I was quite a loner. I was never very gregarious. I never had a great gang of friends. I was much supported from time to time by teachers. There was a man called Bill Reeves, who was an English teacher, and he liked me, and he thought I was a good writer, and he gave me an exercise book to write stories in. And there was a lovely man called Mr. Hollyfield, and he invited me to write for the school newspaper, The Conquest, it was called, which is a bit optimistic.
I gather you did wonderfully well in your 11 plus.
I failed miserably, Michael. The head teacher and the vicar chatted and laughed all the way through the 11 plus, and I was distracted by it. So I have attributed my failure to them.
Quite right. Now, you obviously were already feeling you had a way with words. When did you discover that you enjoyed performing and could do it?
Oh, as soon as I was in the school play, in the infant school, I was the queen with a lorgnette. And I had to strut round the stage and call for my husband, who was called Marmaduke. So I really enjoyed that, with this lorgnette saying, Marmaduke, Marmaduke. And everybody laughed, and it sort of went from there, really. I liked performing and I liked writing, and I always tried to be in the school play.
It is fascinating listening to this, Pam, because one does see where so many of the traits in your work come from.
What do you mean, poverty?
Well, yes.
But... yeah, I know, yeah. I don't mean that in a nasty way, but it was pretty basic. My mother was a wonderful mother, and her life was a drudgery. Real drudgery. There was no washing machine. There was no supermarket. She got on her old bike and she went to the butcher and the grocer and the post office and the this and the that. You know, she was a hero. Heroine, I should say.
Pavarotti next.
Yes. This galvanised me. And I saw a film of Pavarotti performing it. Again, it was like the Rachmaninoff. It went straight to the soul. Mm. I loved it.
That's the wonderful thing about music, I think, being an abstract art form, is you don't need to be a musicologist to enjoy it. That's the whole conceit of this programme, really.
Mm. Good. That's very good for me.
Well, we're going to hear Pavarotti singing Vesti la Giuba from Ruggero Leoncavallo's opera I Pagliacci. Of course, it's a story of love and terrible things happening. And you can hear it, can't you, in the music?
Imagine being able to sing like that. Imagine being able to produce a sound like that that has such an effect on people.
Luciano Pavarotti singing Vesti la Giuba from Ruggero Leoncavallo's opera Pagliacci with the National Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Giuseppe Patané. You left school, I think, at about 15, Panos, and first got a secretarial job, as I mentioned, with the civil service, but then opted to join the RAF. Why was that?
Well, I joined the WRAF because I left school at 15, as you say. I went to work in the civil service as a clerk, and I was filling in identical forms all day long, and I couldn't stand it. And three of my four brothers had done national service, and I'd seen them go off to interesting places in the world at no cost to themselves. One had gone to Berlin, one had gone to Cyprus, one was on the aircraft carrier Eagle and went all around the Med and Scandinavia, and they came home with exotic gifts for their little sisters. My brother Jeff brought home some wonderful Turkish slippers with turned up toes and silk type pyjamas and just exotic things. And so I signed up. My father was horrified. Dad said, "You be throwing away the best years of your life." But it just seemed so impossible that they were the best years of my life, filling in these awful forms all day. And it was terrific going into the Air Force because I went to a place called RAF Salita in Singapore, and I was there for 14 months, and then I was at RAF Rheindahlen in Germany. So, I saw all sorts of things I would never otherwise have seen. And they had wonderful facilities for performance. There were choirs, there were folk clubs, there were theatre clubs. So it was a good decision for me.
But the necessary aptitude was missing.
Well, they gave me the wrong job, Michael. I went to this recruiting office in Reading, and I was interviewed by this man called Sergeant Cooper, who I always say I've been looking for with the bread knife ever since, because he put me into this drawing office because I told him I like drawing, because I'm not a bad amateur artist. Anyway, he put me in this drawing office, and it was all about maths and focal lengths and the scale of photography, and I couldn't do it. And because I couldn't do it, nobody ever gave me any of the jobs that came into the office.
You may not have been a good plotter of aerial photographs, but you did start to shine on the stage. What was it like having the chance to perform?
It was tremendous. The first play I was in was called Hall for the Shore, and it was set in Cornwall. And I played a part called Polly Ipplepen, a sort of half-wit resident of the fictitious village. God, everybody said to me, "What a wonderful accent you've learned," you know. Of course, it was the accent I had anyway. Mm. What I did find was that you were transformed from being a nobody to being a somebody. If you could go on the stage in a play and you could convulse them with laughter, the next day you were everybody's friend.
Do you write with that accent in mind? Is that sort of subconscious?
No. I mean, I think the accent has been a very double-edged sword for me, because certainly in the early days I was written off as a sort of Swede basher, carrot cruncher and village idiot, really, if you've got an accent like mine. I don't think it's quite the same now, but... And people used to think I'd put it on, you know. People would say to me, "Oh, you know, you're not on show now, you can drop the accent." But it was the accent I was born with, that my mum and dad had, my granny and grandpa had. Why would I drop it? I would have looked such a fraud if I'd tried to suddenly speak in received pronunciation.
Music from Les Miserables, yes. Next. Yeah. What was it you liked about this?
I love this song. This is Alan Armstrong singing Master of the House, and I love it because I saw him perform it and he portrayed the character perfectly. You know that character, that sneering person who's out on the make. The words are so clever, and I love clever words. I love "Poor Judd is dead" from Oklahoma. You know, "Poor Judd is dead, poor Judd is dead. He's lying oh so peaceful and serene. He's lying at his rest with his hands upon his chest and his fingernails have never been so clean." You know, I just love that kind of funny combination of words that cripples you with laughter. It's so clever. And here I have the same admiration for this song about he charges them for this, he charges them for that, he charges them for sleeping with the window shut, and he pinches their luggage when they come into his inn.
It's one of the most popular songs from the show, with a memorable chorus and some pretty salty language.
"Welcome, monsieur, sit yourself down and meet the best innkeeper in town. As for the rest, all of them crooks, rooking the guests and cooking the books. Seldom do you see honest men like me, a gent of good intent, who's content to be master of the house, doling out the charm, ready with a handshake and an open palm. Tells a saucy tale, makes a little stir, customers appreciate a Bon Vivant. Glad to do me friends a favour, doesn't cost me to be nice, but nothing gets you nothing, everything has got a little price. Master of the house, keeper of the zoo, ready to relieve a mob a sou or two. Watering the wine, making up the weight, picking up their knickknacks when they can't see straight. Everybody loves a landlord, everybody's bosom friend. I do whatever pleases Jesus, damn, I'll bleed them in the end.
Master of the house, quick to catch your eye, never wants a passerby to pass him by. Servant to the poor, butler to the great, comfort a philosopher, a lifelong mate. Everybody's boon companion, everybody's chaperon.
But look up your valises, Jesus won't not skin you to the bone. Enter, monsieur, lie down your load, unlace your boots and rest from the road. This way's a tan, travel's a curse, but here we strive to lighten your purse. Here the goose is cooked, here the fat is fried, and nothing's overlooked till I'm satisfied. Food beyond compare, food beyond belief, mix it in a mincer and pretend it's beef. Kidney of a horse, liver of a cat, filling up the sausages with this and that. Residents are more than welcome, bridal suite is occupied, reasonable charges plus some little extras on the side. Charging for the dice, extra for the mice, 2% for looking in the mirror twice. Here a little slice, there a little cut, 3% for sleeping with a window shut. When it comes to fixing prices, there are lots of tricks he knows, and we're all in creases, all them bits and pieces. Jesus, it's amazing how it grows.
Master of the house, quick to catch your eye, to pass a by a passing by. Servant to the poor, butler to the great, comfort a philosopher, a night-long mate. Everybody's boon companion, isn't everything he's got?
Dirty bunch of geezers, Jesus, what a sorry little lot.
I used to dream that I would meet a prince, but God Almighty, ever seen what's happened since? Master of the house, isn't worth me spit, comfort a philosopher and lifelong shit. Cunning little brain, regular Voltaire, thinks he's quite a lover, but there's not much there. What a cruel trick of nature, landing me with such a louse. God knows I would lost it living with his bastard in the house.
Master of the house,
master in the hall,
captain of philosopher,
baby love,
servant to the poor, butler to the great,
hypocrite and toady and inebriate.
Everybody bless the landlord, everybody bless his spouse,
everybody raise a glass,
raise it up the master's house.
Everybody raise a glass to the master of the house.
I want to get up and dance to that.
Gets you moving. Alan Armstrong singing Master of the House from the original cast recording of Les Miserables. When did you first realise that you could write and perform your own material, Pam?
In the Air Force, really. When I was in Singapore, They had a club night on Fridays when people in the club would get up on the stage and do something entertaining. I didn't want to be in the audience. I wanted to be on the stage doing something. And for the first time, I thought I'd try and put together something that I could perform. So that would have been in the 60s, and I was about 19. But prior to that, when I was 12, I was writing then. I wrote a parody of Lonnie Donegan's Big Grand Coulee Dam and bored my brothers with it, not that they were very interested. So that was a great long parody called Rosie Bell, Who Chanced to Wander from the Straight and Narrow. So I remember writing that when I was 12.
How did you get from there to auditioning for the television talent show Opportunity Knocks?
Well, I was desperate, really. When I came out of the Air Force, I worked in various clerical jobs, and I was very bored. I learned shorthand. The big step that happened was that one evening I was performing in the folk club in Ducklington in the Bell Inn, and BBC...
Everything in your life has this wonderful name, doesn't it?
I know. No, it's true. It's true, you could go there, the Bell Inn at Ducklington, and it had a great folk club. And because folk music was popular, BBC Radio Oxford sent people out to record bits and bobs for the folk programme on BBC Radio Oxford. And I was declaiming, I wish I looked after my teeth, or one of those gems. And they liked it, and they asked me to go in and perform a poem on the poetry spot. It was a poem called The Battery Hen, and it was picked up on Pick of the Week. It was picked up by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, broadcast all across Canada, and I got enormous amounts of fan mail about it. I was working as a secretary, and I couldn't open the door for the post that had come saying, where can we get a copy of the poem?
So it all began in Ducklington.
Well, it started before then, but Ducklington was important. Somebody suggested I went on Opportunity Knocks, and I'd read somewhere that it relieved people of the burden of their own ambition. So I thought, I'll give it a go and see what professionals make of me. I went for an audition for Opportunity Knocks in Birmingham, and that was thrilling because the reaction astounded me, because there was a great big sign-up saying only successful candidates will be notified by letter, this, you know, this terse message. And yet, when I had done a couple of my poems, they treated me like I was gold dust. They said, you're definitely on the programme. If any other television company approaches you, you must contact us straight away. You know, I walked out of there in disbelief. Because they said, and I believe it, that I was doing something different. And that was what they hoped for and hardly ever found.
And do you have quite vivid memories of Opportunity Knocks, after all, some 50 years ago?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I got mixed feelings about it, really. It was thrilling at the time. And the funny thing is, I can still smell the dressing room. It had this funny sort of talcum powder smell. But it was so thrilling to be in a proper dressing room, you know, in a television studio with lights around the mirror. Oh, it was absolutely thrilling. And I remember the fear. I remember the disappointment of the set. Because when I was on the Opportunity Knocks programme, there were lots of other acts. And they had quite glamorous sets. And there was a singer a bit like Gene Pitney, who had aluminium strips behind him, like a nightclub, and dry ice puffed round his feet. I had no inkling what set they were going to give me. And what they actually gave me was this great big comfy armchair and a table and a teapot with a knitted tea cosy on it. And that was my glamorous set. And it was because I got sort of pigeonholed into being this kind of wholemeal loaf, if you know what I mean.
Well, let's go to another Christmas song now.
This concerns disappointment, really, and my naivety, because Dudley, my lovely husband, and I went to Australia on a cruise ship, and it was going to be a trip of a lifetime. But anyway, it was in 2020 and COVID clamped down and it turned into a catastrophe. But on the way, one of the destinations was Bethlehem. And I had this vision in my mind of Bethlehem which I had seen on innumerable Christmas cards, and it was a little valley in the moonlight with starlight shining down upon it. And it was sort of, it wasn't like the Christmas cards at all, Michael. It was sort of, it was raining. It was a sprawl of unlovely buildings and a lot of tat for sale. So I was disappointed. So this lovely carol is preserving my glimpse of the town as I would have liked it to be.
Shedding starlight on it.
Yeah.
The choir of St John's College, Cambridge, with John Challenger playing the organ and conducted by Andrew Nessinger in O Little Town of Bethlehem. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the poet Pam Ayres. And I was hoping you might read a little festive poem, Pam, Crabby Christmas, which perhaps rhymes with your experience of Bethlehem.
Oh, it's a very, it's a very miserable piece, but the reason I wrote Crabby Christmas was because when I was a child, I remember distinctly the feeling on Christmas Day that it was a magical day. This was the day on which Christ was born, Everything had been leading up to it, and this was the day, and it seemed just so special. And I don't feel that now. It seems to have moved so far away from what seemed important to me. So this is a fairly cynical piece called Crabby Christmas. Hear the rasping of the tinsel and the rattle of the cash. The streets are full of shoppers and the shops are full of trash. Christmas is a-coming, tally-ho and toodaloo. There's a Santa on the chimney and his leg is down the flue. There's a reindeer on the rooftop, there are sleigh bells on the sled. There is flickering and flashing, they are going white and red. The silent starry night is by illumination rent. I know God said, I am the light. But is this what he meant? See my neighbour's house as an electric Yuletide log, a robin and a snowman and a, yep, Kermit the Frog. The local power station, it is standing all aglow and it's heading for a meltdown like Chernobyl long ago. Oh, I am going down the garden. I am going down the shed. If anybody wants me, you can tell them I have fled. I might emerge on Boxing Day if common sense prevails, and I'll buy you all a present. They'll be cheaper in the sales.
Well, it has become very commercial, hasn't it, the whole thing?
Yeah, I know. I do love my own Christmas when I've got my lovely family round me and my sons, our sons and our grandchildren, and that's what matters.
Pam, the experience of appearing on Opportunity Knocks may have been a letdown, but it meant you went from relative obscurity to countrywide fame almost overnight. What was that like to cope with?
Yeah, it was a very odd transition, because 1 minute I was a fairly down-at-heel secretary driving an old Morris 1000 and working as a board shorthand typist, but hugely enjoying the performing I was doing in the evening. And then suddenly the phone never stopped ringing. The BBC took me under their wing, much more so than Opportunity Knocks did, because Opportunity Knocks didn't look after me. I lost my copyrights afterwards and all sorts of horrors arose. But I was offered a television commercial for £600 for cream cheese, which was more money than I had ever dreamed of. And I had to write a verse. Would you like to hear the verse? It's slightly suggestive. It was for a cheese called Eden Vale. I'll see if I can remember it. I always like Eden Vale. It's natural and it's nice. There's one thing better than having it once, and that is having it twice, for which I was paid £600. And I thought, if somebody's daft enough to give me £600, I'm going to grab it with both hands. And that strengthened me to give up my secretary's job. And I left it on Friday, the 13th of February, 1976. And I walked out of the factory gates.
The car was upgraded.
I got an MGB GT, wow, which was the car of my dreams. It was like lying flat on your back on the road, you know. I got one in a beautiful cognac colour. And suddenly, everybody knew who I was. I was thrilled. I mean, anybody who's been a nobody all their life, it's very nice to be suddenly celebrated. Mm-hmm. But it can tarnish.
You did a show for London Weekend, The World of Pam Ayres.
Oh, it was a disaster, Michael. I was offered this 13-week television series for London Weekend, and my agent said, this is what people dream of. This is what performers dream of. You've got to take it. And I remember saying to her, I cannot write 3/4 of an hour's worth of stuff for 13 weeks. I cannot do it. And she said the magic words, will bring in somebody who will write in your style. And the only person who writes in my style is me. Thank you very much. And these tired old script writers came in and they wrote horrible sketches. And Mr. Reeves, my old English teacher, wrote into the programme and protested because he thought I was better than what they had given me to say. And I knew it was awful. And people hated me after that. It was a bad time, really. It was a rubbish TV series. And it got panned deservedly. And then I was kind of written off, really, and I had to start again.
But fortunately, originality won out. And actually, originality is the word that one might hang on to in terms of the old WT experience, because it's very important to retain your own voice and your own control over your work, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was a hard lesson to learn. You know, I should have stuck to my guns. When she said, this is what all performers dream of, and I should have said, no way, where's the door? But I didn't.
Another Christmas song now, but one that's very special to you.
Oh, yes. This is Johnny Mathis, When a Child is Born. And I love this. I love the words. You feel you're on solid ground. And also it reminds me that our own son was born on December the 12th, my first son. We were lucky enough to have two lovely sons. And when I looked at the other babies in the maternity ward, I was guilty of uncharitable thoughts, Michael. And I wrote the following. I wrote, my baby's eyes are bluer than yours. He's got much more hair and he's stronger. He's ever so bright and he sleeps through the night. And of our two, I'd say mine is longer. I swear it's the truth. Mine is cut in a tooth and he's obviously going to be tall. So it's hard to explain now I've looked at your Wayne, why you bothered to have one at all.
Silent wish sails the seven seas. The winds of change whisper in the trees, and the walls of doubt crumble, tossed and torn. This comes to pass when a child is born. A rosy hue settles all around. You've got the feel, you're on solid ground. For a spell or two, no one seems forlorn. This comes to pass when a child. And all of this happens because the world is waiting, waiting for one child. Black, white, yellow, no one knows. But a child that will grow up and turn tears to laughter, hate to love, war to peace, and everyone to everyone's neighbor. And misery and suffering will be words to be forgotten forever. It's all a dream, an illusion now. It must come true, sometime soon, somehow. All across the land, dawns a brand new morn. This comes to pass. Oh,
I rather prefer it when he sticks to singing myself, because the voice is so beautiful.
Yes, I agree.
We could suggest to him that in future...
That's right. Yeah. You could suggest a snip there.
When a Child is Born, sung by Johnny Mathis. I imagine from what you've said, well, we've heard a wonderful example, that motherhood actually inspired your writing to a degree.
Yes. I mean, in many ways, my writing has been a bit like a diary. You know, when I first came on the scene, I was writing about my animals, my pets, my boyfriends. And then I wrote about having young children. And then I've really drawn on my experience as a parent.
Presumably you had to juggle things a bit just to work in both.
Yeah. I sometimes feel guilty about it because I was so driven. I was so driven when I was in my 30s. I was bursting with ideas and things to write. I wanted to write things. And sometimes my little son would come toddling in and I was so wrapped in what I was trying to write and I didn't give him the time I should have done. And I feel guilty about that now. And I think that's true for any mother, really. You feel torn. I hope they thought I was a good mum. I did my best, but I did feel very driven as a writer. I was full of ideas, and it seemed awful to ignore those ideas.
Did you find you were able to move on in your life after all the LWT business and starting up again? Was that quite a challenge?
What helped me a lot to get going again after my family didn't need me so much was that I was offered a programme at Pebble Mill, BBC Pebble Mill, an afternoon Sunday programme. I took over from Charlie Chester and I was very nervous, but it was a nice programme and I was able to put in my poems and my sense of humour and the things that I was interested in and cooking and gardening and all that. And it did then make a difference to the amount of people who were coming to my performances. That helped me to pick up and get going again.
Elgar next.
Yeah, this is sad, really, because I've included this piece, Nimrod, for my sister, because I had four brothers and one sister, and my sister and I were really close friends, and she died in April of this year. And I adored her. She was my best friend, and I could have told her, even if I'd murdered somebody, you know, I could have told my sister. And I miss her every day, and when things happen and go wrong, I can't ring her, and I always used to. I'm going to feel weepy now. When she was carried out in her nice basketry coffin with flowers on, this is what they played. They played Nimrod. But I did write my sister a poem, and I wrote it while she was alive and well, because I wanted her to know what she'd meant to me in my life. This is called Jean's Poem, but really it's for anybody you love. I don't know if there is a heaven with green meadows and woods, banks studded with primroses, the sound of water trickling on mossy stones, and things of great beauty, ferns frozen within icicles, the harebell, the sun on the sea, a snugly wrapped baby, a puppy dog. I don't know if there is a place where animals are treated kindly at last, where there is love and light as we read in our holy books, where we may sit at God's right hand and be judged pound for pound, good for bad, where angels sing up there in the cloud somewhere, in some other sphere, another realm, after we are gone from our homes, gone away, died on such and such a date. But I know this. You were crucial to me all my life. You made the dark times more bearable, the bright days brighter. You punctuated the years with warmth and colour, and knowing that you loved me with all my flaws, I was strengthened and comforted. And after we have gone, wherever we are, whatever we shall be, I will come looking for you, and you come looking for me.
Variations on an original theme by Elgar. That was Variation 9, Nimrod, performed by the Bergen Philharmonic and their conductor, Andrew Litton. And it echoed very nicely your poem, didn't it? There was something about, again, that yearning quality.
Yes.
And a feeling of love, because he wrote it about his friends, Elgar. Each,
did he?
Yeah, each variation of the Enigma Variations was dedicated to somebody who meant a lot to him.
Oh, really? That's nice.
Yeah. Of course, Pamers, you're extremely famous for your comic verses from Rotten Teeth to Overbearing Husbands. But you've never shied away from tackling difficult subjects, as we heard just now. Do you find people respond equally to the things you write about?
People look to me for a laugh, and I do my best to provide one. But because I do a one-woman show which lasts 2 hours, you have to introduce light and shade. You can't try and be thigh-slappingly funny all the time. And so I have other serious poems. I have one called Pollen on the Wind, about moving away from the family home, because we lived in our house for 28 years and there was a cedar atlantica in front of the house. And at certain times of the year, great clouds of yellow pollen would blow away from it like smoke. And I wrote a poem called Pollen on the Wind, which was about leaving the family home and how hard that was. So I put that in, and that makes people stop in their tracks, you know, that gives us a bit of light and shade. And I also have a poem called Tippy Tappy Feet, which is about losing a little dog. And you used to hear the little dog's tippy tappy feet coming tearing down to greet you when you came in the front door, and then suddenly there's silence. So I put those more serious poems in for contrast.
And a love of the natural world, of course, from your early days writing about poor hedgehogs squashed on the road. Do you look back at these and wonder how, rather like Christmas, the world has changed?
I'm very sad about wildlife, because when I grew up, I was surrounded by wildlife. There were scores of hedgehogs and thousands of swifts and swallows and cuckoos and rabbits and foxes and hares. And now I see this enormous decline, and I have spent an unwise amount of money on 22 acres of land in 2019, which I manage for wildlife. And it's so touching, because I've planted, well, I didn't do them myself, I paid a man to plant about 700 native trees, and we dug a pond, and I never see a frog or a toad during the year. But in February or March, it's suddenly full of all these fornicating toads and frogs. And then the borders of the pond are black with tadpoles. And I haven't seen that since I was a child. So I fear that there's nothing that can be done to halt the decline. But I'm trying to do a little bit in my oasis.
Now, as well as that, you have, at the age of 75, embarked on becoming a pianist, haven't you? Doubtless you're going to play us something wonderful.
Oh, you wouldn't enjoy it. You wouldn't enjoy it, Michael. But yes, the reason I started to try to learn to play the piano is, A, because I think it's good for your brain when you're older to learn some kind of a new language. But much more importantly, I have started to write lyrics for songs. I was approached in 2019 by a young man called Louis Mander. And Louis is a music teacher, and he asked me if I would write the words to a school's version of Peter Pan. And I absolutely loved it. I wrote for the Crocodile and Tinkerbell and Captain Hook. I wrote him a song called Lost with All Hands. I just revelled in it. And I've got my daughter-in-law's piano in our house, as it happened. And Louis sent me various bits and bobs of exercises that you could do to start strengthening your fingers at the very beginning. And he sent me this recording of Chopin, something to aim for when I was plodding through Bobby Shafto, really.
Thank you.
The Chopin Nocturne No. 2 in E-flat, performed by Jan Liszewski, recorded live at the Royal Albert Hall during the BBC Proms in 2023. How is your piano playing going, Pam?
I'm learning to play the piano. I wish I had done so before. My husband, a classical lover, gets up and closes the door. This morning I murdered Beethoven. Today it's a Tchaikovsky score. Tomorrow I'll slaughter Stravinsky, and tickets are free on the door. It's great, actually. I do love it. I find it very difficult. But the reason I've started to learn to play the piano is because it seemed to me to be presumptuous to claim to be writing songs when I had no grasp of musical notation. I don't enjoy seeing other people read my poems. I always want to get them by the throat and shake them and say, you're saying it all wrong. You know, you can get a lot of humour out of the poems if you say them in the right way. But songs, I can't sing. And so therefore, if I've written a song and somebody who has a good voice can sing it, I love that. And I've been writing with George Fenton, and that's been really magical, because I can write and I can give my words a certain impact. But to add the right music from somebody who knows what they're doing, it makes such a huge difference. And George and I have written a musical called Who Are You Calling Vermin, which is about the decline in wildlife that I have seen. And it's a kind of satire, and it's a little story about the animals and the people who live in the country. But it's kind of dark because it's about the undercurrents. And I've so enjoyed writing that with George.
Will you share your love of working with George with Alan Bennett, because he also likes working with him?
Yes, indeed. Now, I feel very fortunate to be working with George, because what he has done with my lyrics has astounded me. And this next piece is a piece called The Barn Owl Ballad. And this is sung by Natalie Dunn. And it's about the barn owls that, because so many barns are now converted into houses, they find it much more difficult to find a home.
Old barns are converted, which once stood deserted, once welcoming, lonely and dark. He has lost the white bird who once could be heard, haunting and eerie and stark. Ponds have diminished, filled in and finished, where tadpoles reliably hatched. No banks all a wriggle with blob and a squiggle, and never a frog to be snatched.
Barn Owl Ballad, sung by Natalie Dunn, with music by George Fenton and words by my guest, Pam Ayres. Is it nice to hear your words put to music?
Yes, it's lovely, really lovely. It's been a wonderful new departure for me to write songs. In the early days, when I was on Opportunity Knox, there was a ghastly attempt to make me say my poems to crummy music. So, for instance, I remember on one occasion I was encouraged to recite I Wish I Looked After My Teeth, or one of my early poems, to English Country Garden. Well, the two rhythms are completely different. It was a catastrophe. But somehow people thought that the poems weren't enough. The people then who were in control thought that the poems weren't enough, but they were, really.
In the introduction to your collection, Doggedly Onward, A Life in Poems, you say that you didn't set out to be a poet and that you're faintly surprised to be described as one now. I'm surprised you've not somehow come to terms with who you are and what you do.
Yes, I know what you mean. It's just that when I think about poets, I think of Sylvia Plath and people who are serious and profound.
T.S. Eliot.
And I'm not belittling what I do, because it's hard. It's hard to get the thing to bounce along and get a big laugh at the end and to choose a subject that people identify with. The most recent thing I've written is about internet shopping. It's called I'll Have to Send Them Back. And it gets a huge laugh, you know, because so many people have to send stuff back that you've ordered with such optimism. So I don't think that what I do is easy or without value. I just don't think it's poetry in the accepted sense. But I don't know what else to call it. I mean, comic verse, you can say humorous verse, but that's all a bit of a mouthful. It's more alliterative to say Pam's poems.
Well, I think the most important thing is you've given huge pleasure to millions of people. You're a wonderful performer of your work. And no living poet has sold more books in the UK than you, which is not bad, is it? Now, I think there's, before we say goodbye, a family connection to your final piece of music, the Rodrigo.
Yes, my niece, Tanya, I have lovely nieces, and Tanya is very musical, and she plays the flugelhorn in Wantage Silver Band for 12 years, and I love that band because I think they do a lot of good work where ordinary people can go along and enjoy playing music. And Tanya plays this, she calls it orange juice. I think it's commonly known as orange juice by a lot of people. But she plays this on her flugelhorn, and I've seen her play, and I think it's very beautiful.
Well, let's end then with music from Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez. Pam Ayres, thank you very much for joining us this Christmas on Private Passions.
Well, I've enjoyed it, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
Music from Rodrigo's Concierto de Aranjuez, performed by the Brighouse and Rastrick Brass Band, with Brian Winter on the flugelhorn, conducted by David Hurst. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the poet Pam Ayres. The programme was produced by Katie Hickman.
Hello?
Santa?
It's an old sugar here.
On BBC iPlayer.
Thanks for the slippers.
Shall I make us a little Christmas fettuccine?
Oh, we'll have the perfect family Christmas.
Amanda Land.
That's what I call a tree. Is it plastic?
Celebrity Apprentice.
I don't suppose you need a few extra elves, do you?
The Holiday.
It is Christmas Eve, and we are going to celebrate being young and being alive.
And so much more. Festive fun for all the family.
Well, I hope they don't come up with a load of old baubles.
On BBC iPlayer.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3 on this Sunday afternoon. Hello from me, Jane Royce. Now at coming up to 1:30, Sarah Moore-Peach plots a musical course from A Vision of Mount Parnassus and Percy Grainger's Shepherds towards a much-loved Baroque work for Christmas.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we take a piece of classical music and set it in context in a world of connected sounds. And today, we're headed indoors on a winter's night for this destination. This is one of Arcangelo Corelli's late 17th century Concerti Grossi, and it's best known by its nickname, the Christmas Concerto. We'll hear the whole thing, all six movements, at the end of today's show. And it's a piece of music which really has become synonymous with Christmas Eve. Here's another.